The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gassagene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com. The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium held in Maryland, USA for fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box, and if you would like to know more about their next event, their website is www.scintillation.org.
This episode was recorded in front of a live audience at 221 BCon 2014. Go to 221bcon.com to learn out more about their next convention next year.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Maybe in a minute we'll have microphone backup, but meanwhile, welcome to the 221 BCon Live Baker Street Babes podcast for the second year running. And can we all have a round of applause for how awesome 221 BCon is? Because hello, 221 BCon is the sheaves. Fantastic. I love it. So, the Baker Street Babes, we are very, very delighted to be here and to have this time to podcast with you folks. We hardly ever get to record in front of a live audience, so that makes all of this awesome. Our guest today is Ashley. She's going to pronounce her last name.
Palaszczuk.
Palaszczuk, because I never get the emphasis on the right syllable. So, Palaszczuk. Ashley Palaszczuk is a friend of ours from back in the day, and she has a very interesting Sherlockian background because Ashley is the only person I know of in the world who is about to be a PhD in Sherlock Holmes film studies as a doctorate. So how cool is that, right? She's been interviewed by Mo Rocca, as was I, but I was out of it.
They chose her.
Yes, they chose well. On CBS Sunday Morning, she's been interviewed by other major news organizations. She has all kinds of wonderful opinions about Sherlockian film, and thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. I've been trying to worm my way onto the podcast forever, so
her
machinations, I made it.
Her machinations have worked.
Dream big, Ashley. Dream big.
My whole life has been leading up to this moment.
So we're going to ask you the first four questions, which are the, ones that get you inducted as an honorary Baker Street babe. First of all, would you please tell everyone in your best Christopher Lee projection voice how you discovered the Sherlock Holmes canon and came to love Sherlock Holmes?
Do I have to do it as Christopher Lee?
No.
Okay.
You can do it as
Ashley. That's a bonus.
That's a bonus. I was in a small house in Scotland. I like to take the bonuses where I can get them. I'm a teacher. I learned that. Yep. I was in studying abroad in Scotland at the University of St. Andrews, and I started dating an Englishman, and we recognized that we'd only have a couple months to be dating before I would come back to America and it wouldn't work anymore. And we decided that in order to skip a whole bunch of the boring how's the weather questions, we would exchange book lists so we could figure out what we each like to read, and then we would learn about each other that way, sort of as study time. And the first thing on the list that he gave me was the entire Sherlock Holmes canon. So I went to a used bookstore. I paid £3 for a really trashy copy of all the short stories with the cover was falling off. And I sat under my bed covers with a flashlight.
Literally?
And literally under the bed covers with a flashlight because I had a terrible roommate.
And you and Michael Dearder are the same person.
Yay. I'm so happy now. And I am not dating him anymore, but I am still dating Sherlock Holmes.
So, second question. Who is out of... Well, this is a difficult question for you particularly, and specifically, what's your favorite Sherlockian adaptation? And, like, normally when we ask people this, it's someone who's probably seen, you know, 5 or 6 adaptations, or maybe 10 or 12, and you've seen 1 gajillion bajillion adaptations. So, which is your favorite?
Lindsay Faye, I hate your face for this question. It totally depends on what mood I'm in. Sometimes I'm in, like, a really happy mood and nostalgic, and I like to watch Jeremy Brett. Sometimes I like to watch a really terrible adaptation. Sometimes I like to laugh hysterically, so I watch the Russian Vasily Levanov, Count of the Baskervilles, with Baskerville in, like, giant chaps riding across the moors. And their terrible Americanized English translated into Russian. It's very bad. I love that. So I don't know. That's a terrible question. There is no answer to that question. There's no answer.
Who's your favorite canonical character? Even better question.
Well, apart from the obvious choices, I'm really fond of Mary Brackenstall.
Oh.
Lady Mary Brackenstall is brilliant.
She wins at not having a horrible husband anymore.
Right?
Which is a good thing to win at, I think.
Oh my god, that guy set her dog on fire.
On fire.
On fire. Yeah, Mary Brackenstall is a huge badass. The fact that she lived through that relationship just is a testament to human awesomeness. So.
And it ended with her going, and I think I'll take that sailor.
And I'll have that sailor.
That one. You.
Thank you. Put it on my tab. He's very triangular in my mind.
Yes.
Like Captain Crocker, you know, with the, like, chesticles. And
yeah.
And the pelvic, you know, those little muscle markings right there.
I know very few people who have those, so.
Anyway, that's just the Captain Jack Crocker in my mind, so let's move on.
Yeah.
Woo! Yes. This is a completely different question from who's your favorite canonical character. Who would you most like to have tea with from the canon?
Probably Mrs. Hudson.
Yeah.
Because she's got all the dirt. I don't want to hear what Watson tells us because he tells us, like, the sanitized story. I want Mrs. Hudson who's like, meanwhile, in the middle of that case that took 2 weeks, you should have seen what they were doing.
Oh, man, to be a fly on that wall.
That's the tea I want.
So I know that lots of us have questions for you because we can talk about any aspect of Sherlockian film that exists. So, Amy, do you want to...
I want to ask first a very basic question that I'm sure you probably answered a lot, which is why film and not print? Because obviously you came to the stories through print, as many of us who are not coming from a TV adaptation did. Mm-hmm. And what was it about Sherlock Holmes on film that sparked your interest to the point of wanting to study it?
I was doing a bachelor's degree in communications with a focus on television and film studies. So it was already the thing that I was interested in. And I found that while I was doing that, every time I had to write a research paper, I secretly tried to write it about books. So I thought, well, I guess I'll do a master's degree in literature because obviously that's secretly what I want to do. And then every time I tried to write a research paper, I was secretly writing it about film. So when it came time to do my master's thesis, I was like, screw it, I'm going to do both. And the only way to do that is to study adaptation specifically. So that's how I ended up there. And it became really interesting. I found that every time I tried to write something, I would go first to research materials to try to go, well, somebody has obviously written this paper before because this has been around forever and this is the most interesting subject in the world and everybody must have written this and read it and I'm just an idiot because I've never seen it before and I think, oh, I'm special and new. And I would go and try to find it and I could not find it ever. And it's happened a bunch of times where I've been like, I guess it doesn't exist, I'll have to write it. And that's not necessarily the case with literature, it kind of gets churned over a lot more.
Yeah, that I had been wanting to ask you a similar question, but on a different tack. You suddenly had the audacity to say, I'm going to become a doctor of Sherlockian film. And how did you then go about accomplishing that in the academic sense? Because obviously you have to find the right institution where that is going to go well. And then, you know, it's like, Dr. Polashek, hey, what are you a doctor of? Sherlock Holmes movies. That's the most awesome thing ever to happen.
Again, it's one of those things where I'm just constantly shocked. I wake up every morning and check my email going, today's the email. It's going to come in from some, like, high academic going, you can't make a career out of this. What are you doing?
Look at your life.
Look at your choices. I got really lucky. I was doing my master's degree in literature at Clemson University, and we just happened to have a professor on staff who dabbles in adaptation studies. The man has two PhDs. One from Yale and one from the New York Institute of Film or something like that.
So he's kind of a lightweight.
He actually has a nameplate that says Dr. Doctor on it. And he's hilarious. He just sits in the dark and watches movies in a T-shirt. He's the best. But I sort of went to my supervisor when I was in the master's program, and I was like, I think I want to write my thesis about Dr. Watson and the Hound of the Baskervilles, but, like, in movies? And she went, okay. And I went, really? That's great, and this is who you should go to. We have a guy on staff who can supervise that project, and I went to him, and I thought, I'm going to go and be like, here are some things I like. And he's going to go, you know what I like? Actual scholarship. You should try that. Here are some subjects you might address. Instead, he was like, this is a great idea. I can't wait to read all the words you write. And I got to the end of my master's thesis, and instead of being bored by my topic, I found that there were tons of stuff that I wanted to say that I couldn't in that context. Mm. And he said, well, if you want to do a PhD in this, the only place you can really go to do it is this university in England that has a dedicated center for the study of adaptations. And I was like, fine, I'll move to England. Woe is me, what a hard life I have. And I went. And I ended up there, and they really liked my project too, so I just got really lucky. I kept stumbling into people who were awesome, which is kind of my life.
I'm just wondering, do you have a ballpark figure of how many adaptations you have sat through?
How many I've sat through? It's more likely that I've sat through some bad ones way too many times than I've sat through, because I don't do, like, a big chronological study. My dissertation doesn't even address tons of adaptations that I'm sure most people have seen just because of what kind of research questions I'm asking. But I've sat through some really bad ones in order to, like, transcribe whole scenes or look for, like, little elements in the mise-en-scene. Like, I did a whole section on costume. So doing screen grabs of Christopher Plummer ridiculously wearing a deerstalker and an Ulster cape to an opera.
Thank you.
That... There's no reason for that.
This started my no deerstalker policy.
That's 3 pages of my dissertation is Christopher Plummer's deerstalker. I'm not kidding. With pictures.
Have you commented on the Watson in the Asylum Sherlock Holmes's costume choices? Which were not actually choices because he was hired after the other actor backed out. That waistcoat really doesn't button.
No. I can't even answer that question.
I haven't seen it. Please go watch it.
Go watch
Change Your Life, Asylum Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you, Amy.
There's a chance we might be showing it in the AV room today because last night we did an entire panel on it and people requested that we show it again today.
Okay. If that's actually happening, like, I had, you know, all sorts of ideas for plans this afternoon and being on panels, I'm just going to skip them. Like, because if Asylum Sherlock Holmes is playing, then I'm there.
Can I bring rum?
Yes.
Awesome.
Why not?
The answer is yes. There are certain chunks of eras of Sherlockian film, and I think that one of the most interesting things about Sherlockian film, and I will imagine that you also find this interesting, is that it has existed practically since film started. So you have certain time periods where Sherlockian film is very prolific, and you have a bunch of stuff going on. You've got this sort of, in the 1940s, everybody really wanted to feel better about World War II, and you have a completely anachronistic, but, you know, very much modern AU of Sherlock Holmes in Basil Rathbone and in the anti-Nazi propaganda films that he was in with Nigel Bruce. And Nigel Bruce, I think, we both think is an extremely interesting and important figure for Sherlockian film, because previous to that, Gillette just wrote Watson out. But you have that era, the 1940s, then you have this huge resurgence in the 1970s with Nicholas Meyer and with, you know, A Study in Terror, Murder by Decree.
Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, Billy Wilder, you have, which is the best. And you have all of these great things happening in the 70s. Then in the 80s, it's really relegated to comedy, essentially. You've got Without a Clue, you've got The Great Mouse Detective, which are both great films, but it's, you know, these are funny films, and then now we're in a new Sherlockian renaissance. So do you look at them in terms of, do you see stages, and do you find that interesting?
Well, it is interesting. A huge part of what I'm doing is addressing Sherlock Holmes, the character, as a cultural artifact, like a unit of cultural information, a meme, and that gets replicated over and over again, and the artifacts that we see that turn up, like DNA creates bodies of organisms, are the adaptations. Mm-hmm. And that which ones survive and how popular they are and how many get made depend entirely on the environment at the time, the cultural environment. So when we talk about the 1940s with Rathbone, for instance, we think about how anachronistic the fighting the Nazi stuff was, but that was the norm. What was really anachronistic in terms of what was being made or what was not usual were The Hound of the Baskervilles and Adventures of Sherlock Holmes in 1939, because until that point, Sherlock had always been a modern character. He had always been contemporized. He was, and previous to that, in, you know, fighting gangsters with ray guns, and he had secretaries with dictaphones, and it was just natural to do that. And it was 1939 that was revolutionary, and that the question we go, well, what was it about the year 1939, I think you can guess, that made people go, I think I'd like to retreat into the past because right now isn't very good. And so that's the Sherlock Holmes that they get then, and it becomes very popular for various reasons. And it does the same thing in different cycles. So what about the 70s was promoted experimentation with the character? Well, we had a kind of culture that was very interested in deconstructing traditional ideas in the 1970s. If you read literary criticism at the time, for instance, we are getting people who are really starting to apply in fiction the ideas that, that like the deconstructionists, like Derrida. I'm so sorry I mentioned Derrida. Derrida. And the instability of...
I used to teach Derrida in our writing center in college.
Oh, I hate his guts. The instability of language and ideas and traditional notions, and one of the things that you can do with that is take a character that everybody is familiar with because he's floating around the cultural consciousness and play with him and see how far he's going to stretch before he snaps. And the thing about Sherlock Holmes is we have stretched him in every direction possible, and we have pulled him apart and put him back together and put him with dinosaurs and Nazis and given him drug problems and female Watsons and put him in London and put him in New York, and he just stays Sherlock Holmes, and it's awesome. He just, like, you can push a button and he just returns to factory settings.
I think that ties in to a question that both Artie, who can't be with us today, from the Babes, and I both had about your studies and about adaptations, which is obviously what unites what you study is that they're all Sherlock Holmes adaptations.
Yes.
But is there some other thread, whether it's a quality or a cultural thing, that you feel like unites those adaptations beyond the fact that they are just at the base level Sherlock Holmes?
I think that depends on how you define Sherlock Holmes. I've actually been in like a big academic argument with people about the difference between adapting narrative and adapting character. And the prevailing idea is that character is a function of narrative and that characters can't exist without narratives. And I make the argument that Sherlock Holmes is kind of outside the narrative. He doesn't need the narrative of any of the stories to survive. You can go watch Robert Downey Jr., and he doesn't have to have any of the canonical backstory to make sense. He doesn't have to have any of that stuff in his future to make sense. You don't have to know any canon in order for that stuff to make sense. Mm-hmm. All you need to do is be able to recognize the lineage of the Holmes character. And I really think that that is what unites them, because the genre doesn't seem to matter, because it can be anything from anime to Disney movies to action adventures, you know, all to heritage films. We're all okay with that. We're okay with any kind of narrative stories. We can switch their backstories, like, all, you know, gender bending Watson, or you know, changing what characters are, who Irene Adler is. We can change that. It doesn't seem to matter. The only stable element has to be that you can go and go, I recognize Sherlock Holmes in some way.
And he can be a mouse.
And he can be a mouse. Or a hound.
Or a cucumber.
Or a tuna.
Thank you. Or a tuna. A tuna.
Mm-hmm. Not a tuna.
Yes, he can.
He can. He can be anything. He can.
That leads into a question that Maria had for you. She'd like to know what some of the craziest film versions are. So we know he's been a mouse and a dog. Any other really weird or non-human versions?
Non-human versions, I'm not sure about. I mean, he does... he gets referenced a lot. The character, as far as it actually be supposed to be Sherlock Holmes, perhaps not as much, but he'll sort of be referenced. For instance, like, you can watch a Tom and Jerry cartoon and they'll put on Deerstalkers, but they're still Tom and Jerry, right? And they do that in, you know, it's Daffy Duck, and he looks like Sherlock Holmes because he's dressed like the Sherlock Holmes that we think of in the Paget illustrations, but he's still meant to be Daffy Duck. So I wouldn't say perhaps those. But there are some really terrible adaptations where they change things about him and make him very strange. So you get my personal least favorite Sherlock Holmes adaptation is Case of Evil.
Screw Rupert Everett.
That's a different terrible one, but I hate everything about...
Oh, that's the James Darcy.
Yeah, I hate everything about Rupert Everett's eyebrows.
Also, yes. Also, the space between his eyebrows is really problematic.
It is.
James Darcy... specifically, like, do you think he's not embodying the ethos of the Sherlock Holmes you're imagining, or do you just think it's a piece of crap?
I think that yes.
But Vincent D'Onofrio was in it. It was supposed to be good.
Drunken orgy Sherlock Holmes is a little. It's not to my taste, and perhaps it's to other people's taste, and that's fine. Whatever, yes. Sherlock Holmes you want, you can have. But don't put him on my plate.
Apologies to anybody who came to the Sherlock Holmes canon through James Darcy. You're sorry.
I'm sorry.
Anything bad about that.
I'm sorry that that was how you came to Sherlock Holmes. That's what I'm sorry about. Because ew.
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 Oh, man.
Why is Watson a medical examiner?
That doesn't make any sense.
What is going on in that movie? Pointless. Sorry.
Did the rest of us have remote questions? Did we? Did Maria?
That was the only person who is not here.
Oh, perfect.
I just had one that I'll save for the end.
Okay, fantastic. So I think that it's also very interesting when you're staring at the character of Sherlock Holmes and the character of Dr. Watson, and this is maybe just one of my personal preoccupations, but since you are a almost doctor of Sherlockiana, can you comment, instead of on the character of Sherlock Holmes, because we spend a little too much time on him without talking about Dr. Watson, because Dr. Watson is amazing, and he's one of the most innovative characters, I think, that any writer has ever come up with. So Dr. Watson, as a sounding board and a partner and a friend, that essentially started with Nigel Bruce, so if you could just go from there.
This is an easy question because that was my master's thesis. My master's thesis wasn't on Sherlock Holmes. It was on Dr. Watson. And what I did was I took all the versions of Hound of the Baskervilles that were available for viewing starting with 1939, and I put them in order and analyzed them for what use Watson was put to in each adaptation to determine if he had, like, a traceable growth. And as far as how he was presented, because I was curious how we got from Nigel Bruce's Watson to what we have now. And at the time that I wrote my master's thesis, the Robert Downey Jr. film hadn't come out yet, but my conclusion of my master's thesis, it was just on the horizon, was based on what I learned predicting how Jude Law would play Dr. Watson in that film. And it was really accurate, actually. And what it was I started with the idea that the canon uses Watson as a first-person narrator, among other things, and filmmakers got frightened of that, and so instead of giving him that role, which is really hard to do on screen because in film and television, the camera is the first-person narrator, and if you have a person talking through it, it's actually distracting rather than helpful. And for a long time, they were just like, well, if that's his role, we don't need it, and they cut him out, William Gillette. Why? And when they got to 1939, they had Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, who were actually really good chums, and they were like, no, if he's going to be in it, he needs things to do. And the role that they came up with was as comic relief. And it was fine for the time, and it may not be the canon Watson that we recognize, but it was a necessary first step to get Watson into the opening credits. And from there, you can go, okay, so he started out as comic relief, and they were like, well, maybe that's a problem, so let's try him as some other things. And then he became like a secretary, and then he was like a home surrogate, where like he would get sent in to do Holmes's bidding, which kind of happens in Hound anyway, but more so here, where it was constantly like, what would Holmes do? I wonder what Holmes would do at this time. Scratchy mustache moment. And twirling. And then, you know, you get into the 80s, and they're like, maybe it would be interesting if they were like a proper partnership. Instead of looking at it like Sherlock Holmes stories, and this is an incidental character, what if they're really like, it's Holmes and Watson, that's the story. And they started doing that, really, Ian Richardson, who didn't get to go on nearly long enough. I loved him as Sherlock Holmes. Two TV movies was not enough. I really wish that he had gone on to do a lot more. But his version was a kind of best friend. And I would say that very shortly after, when we get David Burke and Edward Hardwick, he kind of gets elevated from best friend to what I call life partner. That's what I called him in my thesis. And he moves on to the point where he starts to overtake Holmes as the hero of the stories, because as Watson's importance grows, and as his intelligence grows and his capability grows, Holmes has to get more flaws. So where we had a paragon in Basil Rathbone, we get a more and more flawed Holmes, to the point where we have a Holmes that needs to be managed by Watson, which is what we have now. We have a Holmes who would hurt himself if Watson was not there, and would hurt other people if Watson was not there. He becomes, or she becomes, a moral agent in the story, becomes a dispenser of justice in the story. And I think that that's a very interesting character arc, to the point where now our adaptations are really Watson's story, and Holmes is just there being interesting. He's there to drive the plot and basically make obstacles for Watson. But they're Watson's stories now, which I love. I love Watson. He's the best. That was really long, sorry.
That was awesome.
No, that was awesome. That was the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Woo! I just wanted to ask, is there an adaptation that you really love that you feel like is underseen or underappreciated that you would want to share with the audience?
It so depends on tastes and what you like. I'm really fond of both A Study in Terror mm-hmm. and Murder by Decree. I think that those are relatively well watched. I think The Hammer Hound of the Baskervilles might be my favorite Hound of the Baskervilles from 1959. So if you're not familiar with that one with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, I would say absolutely you can find it. You can find it in your local DVD store on Amazon for like no dollars, basically. And you should watch it and love it and hold it and kiss it and put it under your pillow, because it's lovely and wonderful. There are so many out there that are not good that I don't know. Sometimes you can trust the crowd. You're like, nobody seems to be watching these Matt Frewer adaptations, but I bet that they're wrong and there's some merit there. There's not any merit there, guys.
No, it's not good.
Don't waste your time or your money or your sanity on that stuff.
Well, if you want to look at somebody who has an absolutely inhumanly cool jawline, then definitely watch the Matt Frewer adaptation.
His face makes me upset.
His face is awesome. But, like, I don't know what they're doing.
Not as upset as Rupert Everett's eyebrows, though.
Right. No, his eyebrows are super upsetting. I think Sarah has a quiz for you.
Yes, so you want me to do...
So we're gonna do a bit of a quiz, because she's a doctor. pretty much. So if you're a doctor of Sherlock Holmes film, we're going to ask you some questions. There are right answers to all of these questions, and we will be judging you.
Well, shit.
Especially the first one.
Especially the first question has a right answer.
Don't screw it up. Yes, you really should.
Don't fuck up.
All right.
Just go home now.
Who is the greatest Sherlock Holmes of all time?
Ben Sider.
Thank you. That is the correct answer. That is the correct answer. The Asylum Sherlock Holmes, Ben Sider, is the correct answer. That is the best Sherlock Holmes of all time. Ashley, well played.
Thank you.
She's been listening to the podcast, clearly.
Which actor playing Sherlock Holmes has the most L's in his last name?
What kind of questions are these?
Yeah. Yeah.
The most L's in his last name?
Yeah.
This is a terrible question for radio, because now I'm going to sit here in silence and bring up
that,
a filmography in my head.
We can edit that part out.
Just edit this stuff out. The most L's in his last name.
Yeah.
Oh. If anybody in the audience gets it before me, just shout it out. It'll be fine.
You don't have to have all the answers. It's okay.
I know how to pronounce it.
Oh, sure. Yes, well, his first name is Roger. Hint.
Llewellyn.
Four L's.
Four L's.
Roger Llewellyn. Double L at the beginning, double L in the middle. Ashley, we're going to give you that point anyway.
Well done, Who is the only actor to have done the entire canon?
Clive Merrison.
Correct.
Yay.
On the radio, which is awesome, and if you guys haven't listened to those, you should. Everybody should listen to those. I listen to them on my work every day. It's exactly one episode that gets me to work.
They're perfect. Everyone go listen to Clive Merrison. Right. Not right now. Listen
not right
us.
Now.
Right now, we're so interesting.
Don't go away. Sit down. Sit down.
We're super interesting right now, but later, listen to Clive Merrison.
Name a famous Sherlock Holmes actor who also played John Watson.
Famous Sherlock Holmes actor who also played John Watson. Well, Jeremy Brett did.
Yeah! Woo! She knows so much stuff.
Who is his Holmes?
Well, Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah. Which is the most backwards thing I've
That's
ever
a mistake.
Heard of
yeah, it was a mistake.
That's a mistake.
Fortunately, they realized it was a mistake, and they were like, we've got this whole awesome series to do. It's not going to be you, Charlton Heston. It's not going to be you.
Wait a second.
And then Curly had a question. Who will play Sherlock Holmes in 2034?
2034?
Mm-hmm.
You predicted Jude Law.
She's already magical, so she, you know,
yeah.
Like she Long knows.
Doctor.
Can't take away my letters. Make me cry.
Half the alphabet after her last name. What sort of actor do you think will be playing Sherlock Holmes in the future, like in the, like 20 years from now?
Well, probably a female, an actress would probably be my guess. I would say that would be the next step. Or a race-bent actor. That would be awesome. But you said these have, like, specific correct answers.
No,
so
that one didn't. That one was just testing you.
Oh. Well, I would say that I would hope that we would get a race-bent or a gender-bent Holmes before 20 years from now. I think that's going to be sooner.
Do you think that there's a specific reason for Watson being more easily race and gender bent than Holmes? And I know for a fact that when I first started thinking about Elementary and the way they were casting it, I was really excited to see that Lucy Liu was part of the project. But mm-hmm. I was like, why isn't Holmes reverses and not Watson? And as opposed to Watson, excuse me, instead of Watson, because it seems like in some ways a certain cautiously optimistic measure to take? And do you think that there isn't a fundamental difference between gender and race-bending Holmes as opposed to gender and race-bending Watson?
I think in the case of Elementary, it was a very specific decision that started from a clear place when, having talked to Rob Doherty, whose idea it was, his process was, I want to do a Holmes adaptation. So he'd already started from the Holmes in his brain, which was male, and he was doing research on Holmes, and he was reading psychological profiles that fans had written about Sherlock Holmes, and one of them posited that he was a gynophobe. And so it basically was, that would be hilarious if Holmes was afraid of women. The best thing you could possibly do would be to make Watson a woman. I can't wait to make that happen, and it's just like, I just want to watch him squirm. And it made him laugh so hard that it became part of the show. And that's how that happened.
Yeah.
As far as doing Holmes the same way, the project would have to start from there. I don't think it's like you can go, I want to do a Sherlock Holmes adaptation, and you come up with a whole bunch of concepts, and then you're like halfway through, we should make it a girl.
Right.
I think it has to start from there as the seed of the project, and it just wasn't the case in Elementary. But I think it will be in the future. I think that will come. It will.
When you say that, do you think in the future it'll be a situation where you have a female Sherlock and a female Watson, or is there a chance that we could get a female Sherlock with a male Watson still?
I would love to see the latter. I'm guessing that the former will probably come first.
Well, the former already happened in a comic book, a punk comic book. What's the title of that comic book? Anybody?
Baker Street.
Baker Street. Yeah, Baker Street. Thank you, Amy. Baker Street is an amazing punk-styled comic with a female Holmes and a female Watson. So that's not a film adaptation, but we've, that definitely was in print, which was bad as all hell and totally awesome. The question is always interesting to me because, I think that for me, when I watch adaptations, and I've seen way too many, the Granada Sherlock Holmes theme played during the candle lighting ceremony at my wedding 15 years ago. The people who knew what it was knew what it was. The people who didn't, so it was fine. My husband did know what it was. He knew what he was getting into from the beginning. So there's many an adaptation that's effective, maybe even haplessly effective. Some of them accidentally just work, and some of them are just really well-crafted and put together. But I always find that we were talking last night about various adaptations, and I have no love, unfortunately, and this is probably my own failing, but for Richard Roxburgh's adaptations of The Hound of the Baskervilles, particularly, and that other one that he made that I didn't watch, because they get the Holmes-Watson relationship wrong. In the Richard Roxburgh version, they're very much untrustful of each other, and there's not any, warmth there. And I think that if you are adapting something straight from canon, you have to include this sense of brothers in arms. There has to be that. And that, for me, is the deal breaker. Do you have any deal breakers, when you're watching adaptations, where you're like, no?
I can't afford to, actually, because I like to say that all Holmes adaptations are good for me, whether they're good or bad, because they're job security.
Yeah.
But if I go in with preconceptions about what I think there should be, these qualities that I see in order to justify the thing existing, then it becomes very difficult for me to write about it in a clear-headed way, where the scholarship comes out right. So I can't really do that. There are obviously versions that I will watch in my spare time and like, and versions that unless I'm chain myself to the chair, I will never watch ever again. But I mean, we were actually having a conversation about that particular adaptation that was interesting because you hate it, and I really like it. It's actually one of my favorite Hound of the Baskervilles because it's so atmospheric. And the relationship, that was the last Hound of the Baskervilles that I addressed in my master's thesis because it was the most recent Hound of the Baskervilles that existed at the time, 2001. And it perfectly completed the arc that I was talking about, and that was when Watson overtakes Holmes as both the moral agent and the agent of justice in the story. That's mm-hmm. the only adaptation of Hound of the Baskervilles where we actually see Watson rescue Holmes from the mire during the chase scene at the end. Watson shoots the hound, and Watson shoots Stapleton. And that's the only adaptation where that happens. That doesn't happen in any of the others. It's left out of all of them. So even though they get the relationship wrong in some respects, they get some of Watson Wright in yep. his heroism that's left out, where some of the things that he does and that make him awesome, we don't get to see because we're so focused on Holmes. And so mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons that I actually really like that version.
That is completely awesome. So we're going to open it up to audience questions in a second, but we have one more question for Ashley first. So since you answered the four questions earlier at the beginning of the podcast, you became an honorary Baker Street Babe.
Awesome.
But we would like to revoke your status as an honorary Baker Street Babe, and we would like to fire you from that. Because we would like you to be the 12th Baker Street Babe.
I'm so happy.
Do you want it?
I might cry or wet myself, possibly both.
So now there are 12.
Yay!
You are our Peter Capaldi.
You are. You're so Peter Capaldi, it's not even funny.
Shut the fuck up.
All right, now you can ask questions of the 12th Baker Street Babe or the other
totally
ones.
I'm totally overwhelmed and can't think anymore.
I can't. My brain just turned off. Yes, please.
What are your thoughts on straight canonical canon stories like the Granada, where each episode was like the story exactly, mm-hmm. versus like Sherlock or even the new Russian Sherlock Holmes series, which I love, mm-hmm. where they blend different stories to make almost a canon story, but slightly different or reimagined. What are your thoughts? You know, what's better, what's worse?
I like them both for different reasons. If I like the Granada series, I adore, and it's similar to how I feel about the Douglas Wilmer and later Peter Cushing series in the 1960s, which did the same thing where they really adapted the stories. Some of the stories are really awesome. The truth is that most of the canon is a magical, beautiful thing, and having that on screen is something that is wonderful. And I love Granada is something like if all the things, like if you said which one have you watched most times, not because you had to, it's Granada. And it's not necessarily because Jeremy Brett is my favorite Sherlock Holmes. It's because they have crafted an adaptation of stories that are actually, the way they're written, are very difficult to adapt. Mm-hmm. So they've done something really special, and they get that right, and I love those. The kind of collage quality of Sherlock, for instance, where they drop in little references, and you can see where the sort of the seed in the middle is the canon story, and they've gone on different directions. The thing I love most about that is that stories that, I mean, I know that you guys are with me, you've read the story so many times that when you watch an adaptation that's a strict adaptation of the story, the one thing you don't get anymore is any mystery. And
that's true.
In Sherlock, you never know if they're going to have the solution be canonical or not. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So when they make, in Study in Pink, for instance, they give you Rock, and you're in your brain, you're going, oh, I know this, I get this, yeah, Rachel, but it's not Rachel. But it is Rachel! And it's so exciting because they surprised me, it's hard to do. The only way that you can do that up until
Thank
that point.
Thank you for your input.
Up until that point, the only way that you could do that was to write a whole new story for them and have them embody that. And they do that well in some other places. But being able to have the original canon stories almost made new by having the clues mean different things is, I think, a stroke of genius, and I really love it. So that's a great question.
It's kind of also like a little Easter egg hunt. It's just a reward for watching the show.
It is.
Here's a twisted lip preference, have it.
Yeah.
Shezza. Yes.
You're saying, I think, that the films brought on Nigel Bruce as Watson? I'm thinking, I saw a silent film with John Barrymore as Holmes. Didn't he have a Watson?
The Watsons were there. Nigel Bruce was the first one to have his name in the opening credits with his Sherlock. So he was considered an incidental character up until then, no more important than any of the characters that, for instance, if you were adapting particular stories from the canon, the characters that come and go in that story and are never seen again. They weren't giving him any more credit than that. And Nigel Bruce, because he was a name at the time, he was famous enough in his own right and recognizable, and because Basil Rathbone said, screw you guys, this is my buddy, I love him, and you are going to put Willie in the opening credits, or else, basically, and he got that. Of course, both of them were named in the opening credits in How Do the Baskervilles underneath Richard Greene.
And Basil Rathbone stopped playing Sherlock Holmes after Nigel Bruce passed away.
Yeah, he would never do it again.
He said that he wouldn't do it anymore because it was too sad because Nigel Bruce wasn't alive any longer. Mm-hmm. This happens all the time. It's really interesting to me. Like, you form really intimate relationships with people that you have ongoing work relationships with, right? But, like, particularly as actors, Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone were very important to each other. Jeremy Brett's best friend when he was dying was Edward Hardwick. I think we've all seen Robert Downey Jr. snuggling Jude Law. And clearly, Benedict Cumberbatch lights up like a Christmas tree whenever Martin Freeman walks into a room. So it's one of these really lovely things where it's like these people are having a really good time together, and they have a great working relationship, and they find the characterizations really important, and these are people who, you know, like, are super invested in each other. So I always find that it is a really important story that Basil Rathbone wouldn't play Sherlock Holmes after Nigel Bruce died. Yes?
I hope this isn't a spoiler for later on, but what do you think about the insertion of the Conan Doyle estate in the creative control over the Holmes characters and the canon?
Well, the whole last chapter of my doctoral dissertation is on ownership of the character beyond what's actually in the texts. So in other words, beyond the creative ownership of the actual author Conan Doyle and author Conan Doyle, not Arthur Conan Doyle, author Arthur. And then the creative ownership of, like, studios or directors and so forth. Outside of that, my argument is that the character, because he is a sort of a cultural artifact rather than a creative artifact at this point, he kind of, and has that wonderful elastic quality. We all seem to be able to do what we want with him, regardless of what anybody wants us to do with him. So the Conan Doyle estate couldn't possibly stop Fawnlock from existing if they tried. They couldn't possibly, you know, they could make it miserable for somebody to try to publish a pastiche, which they have. They could make it miserable for people to try to make an adaptation, which they have. But they can't stop you from conceptualizing the character in the way that you want to. And because that's the case, their control is going to get less and less and less and less. And they become, as the internet grows and the kind of networks that create the character and bend the character in all sorts of direction expand, they become more and more ridiculous in their attempt to get control. And I use ridiculous not in the colloquial sense. I mean, they make themselves ridiculous in the literal sense by what they're trying to do. And it's just, it's not going to work. It's right. Just not, you just want to go up to them and say, I know that you want this thing because it's awesome, but it's not going to work. Sorry.
I would maybe correct a small misconception that when people think that the Conan Doyle estate want to have creative control, they don't want to have creative control of anything. They want the money.
They want fiscal
control.
That's all
they want. Yeah. They want fiscal control. They want a slice of the pie. They don't want creative control. They don't care about creative control. They want
Andrea Plunkett. They want cares about creative control.
Let's not talk about Plunkett. Let's never talk about Plunkett. Yeah.
On Ian Richardson, Ashley, I'd like to hear your thoughts on his series Murder Rooms or Dr. Bell, Mr. Doyle. Is that sufficiently Sherlockian to come within your purview?
I have seen bits and pieces of it, but it's not part of what I talk about in my work. But I will say that I absolutely adore Ian Richardson in basically everything he's ever done, right down to the mustard commercial. I mean, he's just marvelous, and I miss him. There are some people who I just go, you didn't have enough time to do all the things in the world that you should have done, and he's one of them. And I just, his Sherlock Holmes was brilliant. I would have liked to have seen him play Sherlock Holmes 20 years prior to when he did, which is the case with an awful lot of them. But I would say that it's worth seeing. All of that is worth seeing. I wouldn't call it necessarily a Sherlock Holmes adaptation. I might use the word appropriation instead. But definitely worth seeing and in the same mold. Yeah.
We're going to have to stop because you have only 5 minutes to get to your next panel, but thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And it's so kind of you to come listen.